the burning of Parliament in Cape Town. Early on Sunday morning, the 2nd of January, Cape Town Fire and Rescue Services received a call that smoke was seen coming out of parliamentary buildings. Firefighters began arriving on the scene within 6 minutes of the report and before any fire alarm had even been made from Parliament itself. So Cape Town Fire and Rescue Services soon had 5 fire engines, 36 firefighters on the scene, and this later swelled to 300 firefighters and 70 vehicles as the blaze continued to spiral out of control throughout Monday. Cape Town City Member of Safety and Security, J.P. Smith, said the fire seems to have started in the office complex at the top floor, which are the offices for the ANC Members of Parliament, and gradually spread to the gymnasium. The roof of the old assembly building had completely collapsed. The main assembly chamber was gutted, and there were cracks showing in the walls, and the fire was still raging. Firefighters fought the blaze throughout Sunday before bringing it what they called under control, but the roof burst into flames again on Monday afternoon after the fire brigade had left. I don't know how that can happen. Many offices were severely gutted by the fire. Great damage was caused by to the new assembly wing, including the new National Assembly Chamber. Police reported that a 49-year-old, and some reports said 51 years old, we keep getting back to reports, so they can't seem to get that right, suspect had been taken into custody. This man was linked to the fire that gutted parts of Parliament, and he appeared in the Cape Town Magistrates Court Tuesday the 4th. He is known as a homeless man sleeping on the streets, and that found him sleeping nearby the fire, and he's meant to have been responsible for this. If you want to start a fire in a building, why go to the top floor? Anyway, the suspect faces charge of housebreaking, theft, arson, National Key Points Act, now they're throwing terrorism charges and the whole book at him. Minister of Public Works, Cruella de Vil, well, named Patricia de Vil, but we've always known her as Cruella de Vil since she was Pan-African Congress leader back in the days of the Upler terrorist attack on St. James. And I first saw Patricia de Vil in 1993 as she led a march of PAC terrorist supporters to the Claremont police station to demand the release of Kaya Makama, the terrorist who'd been machine gunning the congregation on the 25th of July 1993, whom Charles had shot and wounded. And she was leading them from the front, chanting, "One church, one bomb, one minister, one bullet." Well, Cruella de Vil became mayor of Cape Town. She gave us the 800% water tariff charges for the drought that ended 4.5 years ago, and we're still paying. And she confirmed that the sprinkler system at Parliament had failed to operate, considering how she turned all the taps off back for the drought, so-called, back 4.5 years ago. You can understand why she wouldn't want the sprinkler system to operate. The bulbs have been closed. Minister of Public Works, Patricia de Vil, could offer no explanation as to who could have been responsible for turning off not just the sprinkler system, but the smoke detectors, the fire alarms, the whole lot. The fire alarms never sounded until the fire brigade was actually there fighting the fire, which is about 5-6 hours after the fire started. The mayor of Cape Town, Gordon Hill-Lewis, reported that while the parliamentary library had some smoke damage, the fire had not reached the library and it was safe. The mayor described the destruction of so much history as a national tragedy, and it certainly is. It appears that the fire had been raging for some time, many hours in fact, before being reported. And reportedly there were no security personnel within the parliamentary building at the time, as Parliament was not willing to pay workers overtime through the New Year weekend. Unbelievable. The fire was still blazing when Deputy President of the Economic Freedom Fighters, or the Everything for Free Party, EFF, Floyd Chivumbu, announced that this burning of Parliament was an opportunity for relocation of Parliament to Gauteng. Chivumbu demanded that the illogical Cape Town location should be reconsidered. Rather than repairing the buildings, he said, it would be better to move Parliament to Tshwane. By the way, Tshwane is what they're now trying to call Pretoria in Gauteng. A central and easily accessible area where the administrative capital is, that's where the legislature should be. Keeping Parliament in Cape Town is plainly illogical. The pillar is one capital city. What they mean is we shouldn't have multiple capitals. We need centralization in one central place. That's, of course, what totalitarian centralization, Marxist socialists want, whereas Christians tend to want the decentralization model of Switzerland as an idea. At the Union of South Africa in 1910, it was determined that in keeping with the Reformation principles of decentralization, the three branches of government would be geographically separated. The legislative or lawmaking capital would be Cape Town, the mother city, the site of Parliament. Remember, Cape Town has had a parliament since 1853. The mother city has hundreds of years more history than Joburg or Pretoria, which didn't even have one single hut on them at the time that our parliament was established. The judicial capital would be Bloemfontein, with the Supreme Court. And the executive capital would be Pretoria with Union Buildings, where first the Prime Minister and later the President of South Africa would have their headquarters. Union Buildings, built by Sir Herbert Baker. The EFF Member of Parliament, Mobeseni Ndlozi, described the fire as beautiful. On social media, exclaimed, whatever the cause, whatever the intention, it is a beautiful fire, all in capital letters with an exclamation mark. Ndlozi declared that the fire offered South Africa a valuable opportunity for a fresh start to move Parliament to Tshwane. I mean, the fire's still raging, firefighters still busy, and this is what they posted. A fire that allows us to start from scratch, a clean slate. Don't renovate, turn it into a museum as we accept a gift of such a beautiful fire. A clean slate to start afresh in Tshwane. DA Member of Parliament Dean McPherson responded, anyone who celebrates the burning down of Parliament does not deserve to be a Member of Parliament. They are a national disgrace. An official statement from the Everything for Free Party declared, if there is an appetite to curb wasteful government expenditure and to cut all ties relating to colonial frameworks established by those who conquered the nation, this fire must serve as an opportunity to permanently relocate Parliament to Gauteng. This will allow government to work to be synchronized. Don't you love that term? Synchronizing government, which is the very opposite of decentralizing and checks and balances. Because as Christians, we don't believe in centralizing and synchronizing government because we believe in the depravity of man. And therefore, there must be checks and balances because power corrupts, absolute power corrupts absolutely. The EFF has long called for Parliament to be relocated to a central location for political and cost-related reasons. The African Transformation Movement, ATM, which is a new opposition political party, called for a multi-party committee to investigate the suspicious burning of Parliament after the devastation of this historic site on Sunday, the 2nd of January. The ATM declared that everything isn't as it seems. The ATM has noted the burning of Parliament with great suspicion. We trust that this is not another calculated shenanigan to issue unnecessary so-called emergency tenders for refurbishments, private housing of the opening of Parliament, or an attempt to scupper the inevitable secret ballot for no confidence motion in Ramaphosa. They haven't been able to have that vote in the last 22 months. This is the first time Parliament's meeting in 22 months, and lo and behold, they happen to have a fire just the week it's going to reopen. The ATM noted that with the COVID-19 infections declining, with Parliament planning to resume as normal, just hours away from viewing the state capture inquiry report, this fire is suspiciously convenient for the ANC government, which would prefer their failures and their corruption to not be subjected to debates in Parliament. With COVID-19 hospitalizations on the decline, with the relaxation of the regulations, it is becoming clear that the normal operations of Parliament were about to resume, where Ramaphosa and his executive could be held accountable for misgoverning this country. Well, that's ideal. Furthermore, it is suspicious that this happens on the eve of Parliament receiving the state capture report, where Ramaphosa, the ANC, and members of Parliament are implicated. Implicated is a very polite term. A multi-party team should be appointed as a matter of urgency to get to the bottom of this strange and suspicious first time, unprecedented occurrence. The ATM has no confidence in the intelligence services, and thus this matter cannot be left solely in the hands. Remember, the chaos of the 9th of July, riots, looting spree, the attempts to destroy, well, they burned down and looted over 200 warehouses and shopping centres back in 2021. Africa Transformation Movement, it's a new opposition party. They've got quite a lot of seats in the last election. And so remember that the big looting spree chaos that was caused in July of last year was organized by intelligence agents. And you had two sides. The ANC group supporting Ramaphosa were blaming the ANC supporters of Ramaphosa, and Ramaphosa's group were blaming the Zuma ANC supporters. And both of them were accusing intelligence members of supporting the other side of having caused and organized this. So it was an internal ANC faction fight, and we're not too sure which one was to blame, but they were both blaming one another. So how can you trust that intelligence agency that not only didn't warn everyone about this upcoming planned, coordinated looting spree, but also they're the ones who apparently organized it? National Education, Health and Allied Workers Union, I love these long titles, the parliamentary branch chairman said Parliament cannot rely on the police alone. They are outside. They provide excellent security. We are supposed to have PPS, that's Parliamentary Protection Service, inside 24 hours. The PPS were not here because they, the management, said they cannot pay overtime. They cannot pay overtime. I mean, this building's worth billions, and the contents are invaluable and irreplaceable. And they have billions and billions to loot and trillions to loot for their personal entertainment funds. And they can't pay for overtime for security for one of the most valuable properties in the country over the weekend. Had they, the PPS, been there, it would have been able to intervene and minimize the damage, they said. The union said it already contracted administration over health and safety concerns last year. Recommendations of a 2018 report had not even been put into place yet. Dear Member of Parliament, Samantha Graham, also raised concerns about the health and safety compliance issues across the parliamentary precinct in a 2020 independent report and assessment. I understand that the report details of the 30 violations of concern. To date, the September 2020 report has not been publicly released. The House is for efficiency and accountability. Public Works and Infrastructure Minister Cruella de Vil said the report is still being processed. I mean, we need time. Let's not be impatient. You know, it's only 2 years or so. A report titled Fire at the Parliamentary Complex dated the 4th of January, based on observations made during the blaze by firefighters. This is not an investigation. This is just the observations of firefighters on the scene. It's a preliminary report. Sprinklers, which did not activate when the fire broke out on Sunday, were last serviced in 2017. The first aid equipment was outdated. The emergency staircase were not sealed off by fireproof doors. Fireproof doors had been propped open. The fire alarm only went off when the firefighters were already on the scene, something like 5 or 6 hours after the fire started. The sprinkler control valve set on the southern facade of the old assembly building was not activated. Sprinklers did not activate. The sprinklers were last serviced in 2017. See here? 2017, last service. And the next service is scheduled for February 2020. Unbelievable. A major contributing factor to the excessive heat and smoke encountered throughout the building was the open latching of fire doors onto the fire escape staircases using small metal latches. These metal latches are completely and utterly illegal. When I was in the fire brigade, we would do fire inspection services, and the horrific things you would see, you know, like schools chaining the fire escape doors with padlocks, and people piling up fire starters, like huge amounts of paint and other combustibles right under staircases, wooden staircases, which is meant to be a fire escape. People blocking, piling up such rubble in front of the fire escape doors that you can't possibly get out. But the worst one, the one we see all the time, is people propping open fire doors. Now, in any hospital, hotel, big building, Parliament, you've got fire doors. You've got doors that are meant to remain shut all the time. You've even got a spring to make them shut. And you will see them, like Red Cross Hospital, remember how many times we went there and The door's propped up. It's got this big sign on it. This door must remain closed at all times. You know, fire door. And then it's propped open. And then every time I walked past, I'd kick the metal thing or whatever that was propping it open so the thing would shut, swing shut. Next thing, there's a handwritten note next to the sign that's permanently fixed saying this door must remain closed at all times, saying, please keep door open. Now, I know what it is. They're carrying trays, pushing trolleys. This is a bit of an obstacle. It wastes a few seconds. So they just keep them propped open, but that's the problem. In a fire, in any fire, if all the doors are open, a building, no matter how big, will be irretrievably destroyed in 20 minutes. But every door shut will slow down a fire by at least 20 minutes, depending on how good the door is, maybe a couple of hours. So we've got, for example, in real time, the destruction of Casavante's auditorium back in 2008. The whole auditorium burned down, 10,000 seats in 20 minutes, because all the doors were open. And that's the problem. The moment you got all the doors open, a fire just... So all throughout Parliament, every one of these doors, they've put a latch on and keeping the doors that are meant to stay permanently shut. Because if the doors are shut and a fire starts, a fire needs fuel, oxygen, heat. That's the fire triangle. And if it's starved of oxygen, fire dies. And that's why you've got to have fire doors. Fire doors will prevent the fire spreading and also starve it of oxygen. But they manage to feed the fire with enough oxygen by putting these illegal latches on fire doors throughout Parliament. Station Commander J.J. Williams noted, in addition, during my walk around the affected areas, I found the National Assembly sprinkler valve was not serviced. Service date was February 2017. This needs to be done every 3 years. The valve appeared closed. No fire alarm was received by Cape Town Fire Service from old or new National Assembly buildings. HVAC, which is Heating, Ventilation, Air Conditioning System, failed to shut down. You see, in a fire, it should shut down because if it keeps pumping in air, it feeds the fire. If you've got a fire in a room and the room's doors and windows are closed, the fire can smolder in there for hours without spreading because it doesn't have enough oxygen to grow. Fire needs oxygen to grow. And of course, if you open the door, it can suddenly resurge with a fresh amount of oxygen coming. But if the AC's working the whole time, well, it's pumping fresh air to keep the fire going throughout the building. So in a fire, smoke detectors should activate that immediately. It shuts down heating, ventilation, air conditioning to start the fire oxygen. Failed to shut down, forcing the city to isolate the electricity block. Lift safety trip did not operate. Some safety staircases were overcome by smoke due to latching open of fire doors. And this is extremely damning reports right here. This fire began on the top floor where the ANC members of Parliament have their offices. And by the way, I also heard that many of the ANC MPs under investigation for corruption happen to have left their laptops in their offices over the long weekend. So sorry, the evidence that's needed for the Zondo Commission this week, not the dog ate my homework, but the fire destroyed it. So a lot of coincidences coming together here. 10 months ago, mid-March 2021, a fire actually broke out in a committee venue in Old Assembly Wing of Parliament, as far as I know, the only fire that Parliament's had before. But it was confined to the room as the sprinkler system activated, extinguished the fire. Official fire investigation determined this had been electrical fault. Now, I'm guessing this might have been a test run, and it would have seen, we better make sure the sprinkler system's deactivated. This won't work very well if we've got the sprinkler system activated, and we'd better get latches on all those fire doors. Over the last 22 months of lockdown, Parliament has not operated at full capacity, to put it nicely. Copper pipes have been stolen. Drug dealing has been reported. Break-ins and vandalism have been reported, such as the trashing of the Office of Opposition DA Chief Whip, Natasha Mazzoni. So Parliament, if you think it's a crime-free zone, you would be mistaken. Since 30th of July 2015, the PPS, that's the Parliamentary Protection Service, has not had a permanent head. The incumbent leader and the deputy were both suspended over allegations of corruption and security breaches, and one contract ran out while on suspension. So for 7 years, no leader of the Parliamentary Protection Service. What takes so long to either investigate, prosecute, appoint a replacement or whatever? Action SA, another new opposition party, spokesperson condemned the fires as severe security failure. That's putting it mildly. Action SA is appalled by this act of arson that has devastated a country's parliament with what must be regarded as a severe security failure. With confirmation of the arrest of a suspect, it is clear this was no accident. And it becomes difficult to view this tragedy in isolation with the tabling of the State Capture Commission of inquiry next week, or the unrest witnessed in July last year. Now, that just brings one to remember what happened 9th of July 2021. 200 shopping centres looted and burned. Massive looting spree. Coordination. All the breaking in equipment delivered at the right place. Whole streets just filled with empty boxes after all these items had been stolen. The looting spree, the absolute carnage and destruction. We talk about billions and billions of rands worth of damage and devastation. And they targeted some of the biggest warehouses, not just warehouses, and supply centers. And didn't just loot them, but in many cases actually burned them, torched them. And also attacking the trucks on the road, and the entire M3 was just a free fire zone of petrol bombing, of delivery trucks. And at the end of it, it was worked out. This was actually organized and coordinated. It was not spontaneous. So continuing with this quote, in addition to this act of criminality, serious questions have to be asked about the security and fire systems in our parliament. South Africa's parliament is a vital symbol in a constitutional democracy. It was intended to be a sacred place. Sacred meaning set apart. Where lawmakers represent the will of the South African people and hold the president and his cabinet to account. Well, that's the idea. This act of arson has wreaked havoc in this national key point, cannot be reduced to just another fire, but an act committed against the South African people, which is the very definition of treason. Action South Africa's primary focus will be to ensure that law enforcement agencies conduct the investigations rapidly. So when we speak about rapidly, just think of, has anyone here, aside from Justin and I, seen the reports produced on the April 18th fire last year, the wildfires, which apparently jumped hundreds of meters to get inside UCT to destroy the library and jumped over there and got this leapt freeways and only got University of Cape Town residences in Rosebank, Mowbray and Rondebosch, nothing else. But then it's all wildfires. Anyone seen the piece of rubbish that the city brought out trying to... Anyone else? But remember how they were prompted? Don't jump to conclusions. Wait for the official report to come out. Well, I think everyone's still waiting. It sort of slipped out somewhere there, but no media attention given to it because they don't want you to actually know. And here it says it's got to be investigated rapidly and without political interference, especially if this is found to be another consequence of ANC factional fighting. Is this, again, the Zuma versus Ramaphosa factions of the ANC fighting one another again? It was speculated that the fire starting in the ANC members of parliament's offices on the third floor was probably convenient for those who are facing investigation for corruption, with many records being destroyed. It's amazing how many convenient fires there are when there's serious scandals going on. Queen Victoria granted permission for the establishment of Parliament in the Cape Colony 1853. That's before any of us were born, or any of our grandparents either. I mean, that's a long time ago. The first sittings were held in the governor's residence in Tone House. And the upper house was housed in the old Supreme Court buildings, and construction of the parliamentary building in Cape Town began on 1875 with then governor of the Cape, Henry Barclay, laying cornerstone. I don't know how many people remember that was the Cape Colony's flag, the blue flag with the British ensign and the unique Cape seal seen in the setting there. And this is also, again, the Cape Colony's seal. Always with the lady holding the anchor up top, the royal line in the middle, and we've got a Kemsbuck and Wildebeest standing on each side with Proteas as well. So the first architect was Charles Freeman, and you get an idea of the stateliness of this magnificent building, the Cape Parliament. And we should remember, it is the Cape Parliament. This isn't the South African Parliament yet. The presence of groundwater and other complications led to the first architect being replaced by architect Henry Greaves, 1876, and the stately building was finally opened 1884. And a magnificent building indeed. The House of Assembly and Parliament, beautiful wood panelling. In the 1920s, Parliament commissioned Sir Herbert Baker, who designed Union Buildings and a lot of other things too, to build an extension which included a new chamber for the House of Assembly. The old Assembly Chamber became the Parliamentary Dining Room, which was the scene for Sir Harold Macmillan's famous Winds of Change speech. And when I've been to Parliament for lunches and so on, it's tended to be in that particular room, which used to be the old Assembly Chamber. You notice also there's the statue of Queen Victoria positioned out front as well. To this side, to the right, would of course be St. George's Cathedral and the gardens, just orientating you. The Catholic Cathedral on the other side hasn't yet been built at this stage. 1947, the royal family visit Cape Town to particularly thank South Africa for its contribution during the Second World War, and King George VI and Queen Elizabeth, that would be the Queen Mother of the Queen Elizabeth, we know, but she's also was Queen Elizabeth, entering in, and that's what Parliament used to look like in the House of Assembly. And what it looked like before the fire. I don't know how much of this remains right now. I've been in here for hearings and submissions to Parliament. This is often these days used as a committee room, but that's the Parliament in which Prime Minister Hendrik Verwoerd was assassinated in 1966. Further extensions were added in the 1980s under P.W. Botha when he had this whole new development built in order to accommodate the tricameral constitution. And so you can see the old parliamentary building, which is now faded, and the new parliamentary additions that they added on, which is today understood to be our main National Assembly building. And that was what was built in time for the 1983 constitution and the tricameral parliament. The original parliamentary building was designed in a neoclassical style, incorporating features of Cape Dutch architecture. It would be nice if they didn't allow big, tall, ugly buildings like the SARS building to encroach on the side, which has now really undermined the centrality of Parliament in Cape Town. In 1996, after I'd marched tens of thousands of people to Parliament to protest Mandela's paganization attempts to legalize abortion, pornography, perversion, and so on, I was summoned to meet the president at the Krutoskew estate, where the president's house was, where Cecil John Rhodes had donated the buildings for future prime ministers of the Cape. And the subject came up of the ANC's intention to relocate Parliament to Midrand in Gauteng. In fact, this was interesting. I questioned how such an extraordinary huge expense could be justified in light of his promise of housing for all. That was election promise in 1994, Nelson Mandela promised housing for all, as you've noticed.
Yes.
Even 1990s, the money needed to build an equivalent structure to Parliament would cost billions of rands. The National Archives alone, which is in Rowland Street Prison, old Rowland Street Prison, require a colossal amount of floor space. Well, Karl Niehaus, the apostate theological dropout student who was Mandela's so-called theological advisor, who's sitting there, said that the present parliamentary buildings could be sold, maybe to become a hotel, to help finance this. To this I respond that actually they could not. As much of Parliament sits on ground which was owned by the South African Freemasons, the arrangement had been made that the Cape government purchased the land for £1. This, by the way, is in Parliament grounds right now. The only house of worship in Parliament is a Freemason's temple. This is it, right here, the lodge. And I don't know how many people realize that it's a Freemason ground where Parliament sits. They sold it for £1 to the Cape government on condition that if Parliament was ever to be moved, the land and all the buildings on it would be sold back to the Freemasons for the same price. In other words, £1. While Colonius was plainly shocked to hear this, Nelson Mandela sat impassive and he's plainly well aware of this provision, because Nelson Mandela himself was a very senior Freemason, 33 degree. Now here's the Masonic Times of Africa. Mandela is on as the cover picture. He was a very senior Freemason, 33 degree Freemason. Here he is with one of the most famous Freemasons of all, Rockefeller, who's also one of the richest people in the world. And interesting, there you can see Thabo Mbeki is also a Freemason, and you might have missed the fact that Desmond Tutu is also Freemason. We've got a picture of him there too. But so you've got a lot of these very important people, Kofi Annan and all of that, Freemasons. This also rings a few bells. You may recall on the 5th of November, 1605, I know before our time, but remember the 5th of November, the Gunpowder Plot to destroy the Palace of Westminster, which includes the House of Parliament and the House of Lords in London. This was thwarted with the arrest of Guy Fawkes and his associates. Guy Fawkes was part of a conspiracy. In fact, he wasn't even the leader of the plot. He's just the man who purchased the gunpowder and was going to set it off. He was a soldier of fortune, Catholic soldier of fortune. But he wasn't the leader of the plot. He was actually a minor figure in the plot, but he, for some reason, they chose him to associate it with. The Gunpowder Plot of 1605 was to destroy the entire royal family, the entire House of Lords, the whole upper establishment, which would have been the Church of England, hierarchy, the Protestant leaders, all of that. They would have all been there. They had 30-something barrels of gunpowder in the basement of Parliament, smuggled in there. And this was actually the man who was running it. Here's the ringleader, Robert Catesby. And he, it should be actually remembered for him, but he was killed by gunshot while being arrested. And so Guy Fawkes basically became the one they could put on trial and so on. And so he tends to be the one remembered the most. But to this day, the 5th of November is marked with bonfires and the familiar remember the 5th of November, gunpowder, treason, and plot. To attack the Parliament of any people is treason of the highest order. And this also reminds us that back in April last year, the 18th of April last year, which is, by the way, Independence Day, the Revolutionary Day of holiday in Zimbabwe, we had massive wildfires in Cape Town, which devastated hundreds of hectares of the Krugersfuur estate and of the forest on the slopes of Table Mountain, and destroyed the Rosemoyle Tea Garden and chapel. It took days to bring under control, and for some obscure reason, the massive library with over a million books in University of Cape Town was gutted. The Jagger Library, even though it was nowhere near the wildfires, and the buildings around it were unaffected, but here you can see an aerial photograph, you can see the extent of the charred, burnt-out areas. But how is it possible that right there, the Jagger Library, in the middle, there was some magic smoldering ember that leapt hundreds and hundreds of meters of all these other buildings, and even though it had a stone roof, and you could actually see the, when you looked at the outside, I don't have those pictures, but you could actually see the ivy still on the outside of the Jagger Library. And the gutters are still there, and the roof's still there, but somehow or another, the fire inside, it's obviously a fire that was inside, but they're trying to blame a wildfire outside for burning the insides of a stone building. Some of the most valuable library and some irreplaceable materials. When the photographic evidence is, and I walked this area too several times, there's a huge gap between the perimeter. In fact, the perimeter trees weren't even affected. And somehow or another, you get the library in the center of University of Cape Town, far from the wildfires, goes up in smoke, and several other University of Cape Town buildings. And I don't want to say it's arson when it was obviously so, and I want to speak about the fire. But the wildfires, there were plural, multiple fires that were started, and there was, of course, a lot of arson, and the University of Cape Town seen a lot of arson. But again, we're still waiting for an honest and open report on the cause of these wildfires that caused so much devastation. Exodus 22, verse 6 says, if a fire breaks out and spreads, he who starts the fire shall surely make restitution. Well, on our frontlinemissionsa.org, you'll see those previous videos and audios of the communist chaos and opportunism with the riots in July and then the wildfires in Cape Town. And all of this, all of these shenanigans and chaos being caused makes one even more open to the idea of Cape independence, a Cape of Good Hope, where the Cape Parliament can be restored to being the Cape Parliament. And there's a very good case and good examples in history as to why and how the Cape could achieve its independence. We also need to think security and survival, including how to respond to fires and how to prevent fires. And we need to be rebuilding our society on biblical principles, especially the Ten Commandments, which has been undermined at every level, especially in our schools. George Orwell, in his book 1984, said the most effective way to destroy a people is to deny and obliterate their own understanding of their own history. And we are facing a war in history. One of our friends and supporters overseas, who has been watching our resources and so on, wrote two history poems, which I'd like to conclude with before we go to question and answer times. So these are poems written by Tanya Strader. I hold a book within my hand, the book of history's wonderland. I turn the pages and I read of battles past, of brave knight's deed, of kingdoms won and nations lost, settlements killed by winter frost, of empires rising from the dust, of treaties signed and words of trust, of terrors rising, cruelty spread, of graves filled with the helpless dead, of fearful yet courageous heart, when men and lands all did their part, of women brave who sent their love and trusted to their God above, of young lives lost in freedom's cause. Then I stop, I think, I pause. When with trembling touch I turn the page to coming time, to future age, the words are dim, and yet I read that cries will rise for valiant deed. I wonder who will hear that cry. Will many more be forced to die? Or will a mighty hero stand to halt the evil, purge the land? I look again, in vain I stare. The page is blank and pen is there. The end of that great future fight, I realize that I must write. So Tanya Strader wrote that hymn, that poem, and also this one, entitled The Fall of Tyrants. The tyrant on his Roman throne, he sees the world and seeks to own, to hold the nations in his hand, to grasp them like the ocean sand. With power's pleasure as his goal, he brings the earth to his control. Yet for his crimes, through history's swell, the mighty Roman Empire fell. Usurper of the right to reign, no care at all for England's pain. With all he has, he still wants more. He thinks himself above the law. At Runnymede, though it may seem strange, the barons brought about great change. The Magna Carta set in stone, saw tyranny, was overthrown. All China's rights became his prize. He sought above the mass to rise. Evil thoughts, much wider, greater, changed him into cruel dictator. He stamps and spits on people's lives. He crushes families, husbands, wives. He sounds the sweet freedom's call, yet China's tyrant too shall fall. With serpent's taste, through foggy glass, a bully's law he aims to pass. Pacific's despot seems so strong, obeying what is wicked, wrong. While he himself is vile, corrupt, he seeks to lives destroy, disrupt. The law he tries to bow and bend, yet justice triumphs in the end. With sickness, fear, disaster, dread, we see a rise in tyrants spread. For there are always those who seek to take advantage of the weak, who place themselves atop the crowd. They are cruel, deceiving, puffed and proud. Above the law they seek to be, to crush the strong, the brave, the free. Where God is king, there freedom's queen. A lovely picture seldom seen. God's law is always pure and right. It's garbed in goodness, robed in light. We're very grateful for Tanya Stratum's poems that she sent, and it's so important for us to know our history. Our history is under attack, And we need to understand history as a battlefield. We need to know our history. We need to preserve our history, because it is definitely under attack by people who want to cancel culture. That's why the work of Christian Liberty Box is so important. Home education is so vital. Providing good resources online. Reclaiming our continent for Christ. So,